My guest today is Suzanne Northrup. For over 30 years, Suzanne has been an internationally acclaimed medium, grief, and bereavement expert, TV and radio host, and she is the author of 3 books to date, which have helped thousands of people worldwide to recover and heal from the loss of loved ones. Suzanne does so by bridging the gap between the world of the living and the world of spirit. In addition to her 2 top-selling books, Everything Happens for a Reason and Second Chance, Healing Messages from the Afterlife, Suzanne has also broken new ground with A Medium's Cookbook, Recipes for the Soul. In this book, Suzanne shares tips and tools for tapping into your own power to connect with departed loved ones.
Welcome to Interspecies Evolution. The purpose of this podcast is to highlight human consciousness and how our self-awareness can lead to our honoring animals as conscious beings as well. We have gathered more than 3 dozen people with unique experiences and education, inviting them to share their journeys and how their relationships with animals have changed along the way. If you are seeking inspiration on your own journey of awakening, or simply want to improve your relationships with animals, we invite you to join us because it is time for interspecies evolution. Here's your host, Jenny Jablonski.
Welcome to the podcast, Suzanne.
Thank you for having me, Jenny. You came on my radar. You do a lot of things that are very dear to my heart. So I figured that, you know, we would do a good blend.
That's right. In fact, I met you because you invited me on your podcast.
Yes.
And then when I said, oh my gosh, well, I have to have you on my podcast. And yeah. I'm really glad for this opportunity, both personally and for the benefit of the listeners, to get to know you. There, believe it or not, there might be a few people out there that haven't heard about you or haven't yet been able to be touched by your beautiful energy or experience a session with you, understanding what that level of awareness can bring to us when we are grieving, when we are searching for answers. And we're going to talk about that later. But before we do, I want to hear about you. I want to hear about your journey. I want to hear about your earlier life, how this happened. And I know it's going to be fascinating.
This has actually been pretty much, I don't want to say a journey, but it's been pretty much my whole life. And, you know, I know that there's people that have experiences in their lives, that their lives change at the age 20, 30, 40, whatever it is. I don't really know another way, because I had connection at a very young age. And I think when you have connection at a very young age, depending on your experiences around it, usually, you know, your family, all that kind of sort of stuff, which always has an impact on it. Sometimes positive, sometimes not so positive. But I have to say, in my particular case, because I had this at a very young age, I do a lot of work from all different rocks of life, but I've done work with near-death experience people, and they're totally convinced that I had a near-death experience at 5 years old. Well, 5 years old, I was hit by a car. That's true. I went one way and my shoes and socks went the other way. It could have had an effect on me. I don't remember it. My mother said to me that, you know, when I was hit by the car, which, by the way, was a Buick, we make a joke about that, is that I flew one way, they flew the other, and I landed at wherever I landed. I didn't have a scratch. I mean, I had a scratch on me, but I had broke no bones, no anything. So it could have started at that time in my life. But I know as a young person, there were things that I knew before people knew them. Or, you know, like the kids, you know, when I grew up, the stupid boys would do things like jump train tracks. And, you know, and like the one day I knew one day one of them was going to lose a leg. And sure enough, you know, I come home from school and he lost his leg. So a little gruesome, but it's like, but that was a game when I grew up that was a big deal. You know, like they were, you know, I thought they were like cool and they were tough until, one slipped in the wrong way. And then I think maybe they learned from somebody else's bad lesson. And I was an only child for the first 9 years. And I spent a lot of time, you know, literally out in the woods riding horses that weren't horses physically. This is sort of why I have a big connection to you. Before, yes, I was always riding horses out in the woods. That was my means of some sort of communication. And then when I was 13, which is a wonderful age to begin with, my paternal grandmother crossed over. She was this big woman, larger in life, very significant in my life. She got me, you know, me piano lessons from the age of five on, and I thought this was kind of be my life. And she had colon cancer. And so she was this big woman. Then the last time that I physically saw her in the hospital, she was down to like maybe 80 pounds, 90 pounds. She crossed over. And my recollect as a young woman at 13, she came to me, stood at the bottom of my bed. I say this is my Hollywood story. And she stood at the bottom of my bed and she said, keep up with your piano lessons. I'm going to give you my favorite ring in one of my houses. I can't visit you often, but I want you to know that I'll kind of always be there. So that was our visitation. And then the next day or the day after, I couldn't tell you sequentially, my mother said, you know, we're going to go to the parlor. Now, I was much older than my sisters, and I didn't know what the parlor was. But all I know is we went there, and there was this woman in a box dressed in my grandmother's clothes. I was pretty appalled because I said, like, I don't understand this. I just saw her the night before, and she was well. And I thought, you know, the adults are playing a joke on me. And so my mother told me to go sit in the car because my father would be really upset. So I went and sat in the car, and then we drove 100 miles an hour to my one street town. And then I sort of had to figure it out because I think, you know, with death, there's so many questions, particularly with parents and children. And I just know at that time when she died, to me, she looked better dead physically, literally, than she had prior to the last time I saw her in the hospital. So to me, she was going to be well again. That was my concept. With that, to me, I think if every single person had that experience, but not only would they view death very differently, but they would view that loss of that person physically in their life. And they would know, like, okay, it's not going to be the same, but they're not in that pain. They're going to be around me for my life because my grandmother's going to not stop loving me because she left her body. She's always going to be in my life. I always talk about how we have in our lives, all of us have people somewhere along the line, most people that have had a big effect on their lives. And I had like two amazing grandmothers, and I call them my pillars. My maternal's on my right and my paternal's on my left. And they were both amazing women who did amazing things at a period of time that women did not do them. My maternal grandmother was, her wish was to have one kid in the hospital. She had four at home between the ages of 16 and 21. And my other one, you know, she left my grandfather when women did not do that in those days. During the Depression, took my father with her. It was just my father and her, and went and worked for this farmer. The Depression came along and she had just gotten in a really, really bad car accident and he was going to lose his farm. And she said, I'll tell you what, I'll buy your farm from you and then you can work for me. So, I mean, that's pretty tough, pretty ballsy. And so that was my childhood connection with both of them. And then what happened is that, you know, I left home. My father kind of really went off the deep end, to be honest with you. And life was not easy. And I had two younger sisters, one's 12 years younger, one's 9 years younger. I kind of couldn't wait to get out of there. And then I, being from a small town, I moved to New York City, which is quite amazing with $30 in my pocket and my Rambler. When I got there, this door of my connection, like, you know, you go on dates and, you know, the dead boyfriend's grandmother shows up. It's not a cool thing. And I'm trying to like put all this together. I want to say in those days, but literally in those days, you know, that many years ago, because I've been doing this for 40 years, there wasn't a lot out there that you could find. There was no internet. You have to kind of figure your way. And, you know, when I moved to New York, I had a few friends that were all studying to be shrinks. They knew I was different, but again, we didn't know what to call me. There was a point that this guy I was living with, he kept saying, like, they're going to lock you up if you don't keep your mouth shut. He takes me to California where he figured everybody was crazy. So that's kind of what happened. The walls got really big between me and the other world. I had to kind of figure it out. So I did what I knew best. I moved to Northern California, out in the woods somewhere, lived without electricity and water for 3 years, and figured it out. Okay, you know, this is the deal. I'm a little different. You know, I have this connection, whatever you want to call it, with the other world or whatever it is. I'm different, but I'm not crazy. And this is kind of a real thing. And that was sort of how I went into my way. And then I rejoined the world and moved to Los Angeles. And my background was music. I figured that's what I was going to kind of do in my life. And the minute I got to LA, it was interesting. I had a friend who hooked me up kind of with this guy who was ran one of the symphonies. And he said, if you're going to be serious, you really need to go back to school and get your degree in music, which was fine. But weirdly enough, not long after that, he ended up being murdered, which is really like a really kind of cool thing. And in the meantime, that same person said that there was this church in the Masonic Temple, and they did things like with psychics. That's kind of the word, because there was no other venue. I mean, it was either churches that had spiritual centers or things going on, or hotels with people that ran psychic fair. I mean, there was absolutely nothing else. And so I started going there. That opened up the world that I knew to be. And of course, at that time, I got to meet some incredible people. I was like this kid with all these amazing, well-known mediums. And I worked with the woman who was the first, actually one of the first psychics to work with the police department in Los Angeles to help solve the Hillside Strangler case, which was a huge case. And I became her quote unquote star, for lack of better words. And she made me stand up in front of audiences and give messages. And that was sort of how my journey. Now, she was not a medium. There was actually one other medium that I had met during that time who kept telling me, you'll do this work. And I kept saying, like, no, I won't. She kept saying, oh, yeah, you will. Of course, we knew who won at that game. And that was really how my journey sort of started. And I've never, you know, this is the only thing I've ever made a living at. And the thing is, I have a degree in music. I have a master's in music. And, you know, I am talented. Then I ended up moving after going to school in LA and doing all that. You know, they told me I was going to move back east. And that was the last thing I wanted because I'd been in California for 10 years and I loved the weather. And they said, okay, no, you're going to move back east. And I said, okay. So I moved back east and there was not many things that I could make a living at. And I had been doing this. I had been working for free. I'd been doing readings and messages. And the whole time I was in school, that's what I knew. So I moved back east. And, you know, when you do what I do in those days in New York, you're going to get known like really fast. I mean, you're going to get a crash course really fast. And that's what happened. Within not even a year of moving back, I was doing, you know, radio and television, and I was booked 2 years ahead for a point. It was a little overwhelming. And that was sort of like the whole kind of view and sort of the nutshell, sort of how it started for me. Kind of the rest is history. And there was a point, as much as I still did music, this was my path. I still did it. I still wrote, you know, I'm a classical composer, which is, you don't make a lot of money at it anyway, but my shingle was put out and made the decision. And I have to say, honestly, I've never been sorry, because I get to go to a place, and I think you totally understand this, where a lot of people don't get to go with other people. It's a sacred place when you connect a heart-to-heart communication with somebody that they love, that they've lost. It's a privilege and an honor. And like anything in life, you know, when it becomes quote unquote on some level commercial, you got to be really careful that doesn't get lost, and that the bottom line of the work, it has to be ethics, and it has to be the honoring to do this and be chosen to do this. I had a vet many, many years ago who, when my dog got older, she wasn't behaving for him. I remember seeing him slap her, and I was appalled. And I said, you shouldn't be doing this for a living anymore. I mean, once you've lost that sense of caring for animals, or once you've lost that sense where you feel like you're above caring for somebody who's had a loss for whatever reason, or you're in it for the wrong reason. I mean, I started doing readings on the streets of New York City for $3. And people now, you know, they work 6 months and they want, you know, $300. They don't, you know, it's like anything in life, you know, it can lose its beauty, but you have to stay true to what that is. And I know, like, your thing is animals. And I think I don't know if I mentioned this into my email, but I got to meet, you know, Samantha Curry during this whole time, because when I was doing music, she was coming back to New York City to do a huge lecture, because she became also well-known very fast, and she needed music for her lecture. I was contacted her through by the woman that I had worked with, who kind of opened up the door for me. And she said, Sam, you got to meet Suzanne, because Suzanne does music and she does what you do, and she'll be perfect for you. Well, I ended up writing music for her event. And what was incredible is what she sent me music was, she sent me music of, she worked with the animals in the San Diego Zoo. She also worked with the Dobermans at Tom Selleck's show with the Hawaii. So she was really, like me, top notch, with like kind of the same age and stuff. And so when she was working with the elephants, she remembers that going into the zoo one day, and one of the trainers there couldn't get the elephant to do what he wanted the elephant to do. And so she, of course, being Sam, she talked to the elephant, and the elephant basically explained to her that she had just lost her mother and she was grieving. And he had taken her, a baby, away from her mother. I know you know what I'm talking about. To him, it was like an animal. And she says, no, do you understand? You take an elephant to, I mean, and of course she's not going to. So when she told me that, I said, like, can you get me some sounds of elephants? And she goes, sure. So she went to the zoo and recorded sounds of the elephants, and she recorded sounds of the birds. And what I did is I wrote piano music, and then I put all those animal sounds over the piano music, which I have somewhere in my files of works. To me, it was like such an honor to be part of that service. That is the interspecies. We are all connected. We are all connected, and we're all connected through love. That's really what the work is really about. It's not more complicated than that. And, you know, you explain to people like, well, how do you do this? And you're like, well, how do you open up your heart? You do it by opening up your heart. And if you open up your heart and you happen to have, because we all have gifts, and it's just trusting that and seeing what works for you. We have to fine tune whatever our particular expertise are, because we all have it. It's just all particular levels of it. That doesn't necessarily mean everybody should do this work professionally, but it means that if you do believe we are all interconnected, whatever we are, then you'll have to know that there is a heart connection. So I'm trying to think of the name of the book. It was written by Edgar Allan Bourne, and I always forget the name of it, but he wrote it when he was working in Hollywood. He was actually working with Rin Tin Tin. He happened to be working on the show, and he talked about the time this fly came and kept falling on him and sitting on him. And he said the strangest thing came over him is that this fly started to talk to him. And he said, look, if I told anybody, they thought I was completely out of my So he actually named the fly Freddie. I got this book up in my files. I'm going to have to get it and show it to you. But it's how he started his journey about realizing that exactly what we're talking about is this interconnection and how we are all interconnection, all different levels of what that is, the honoring of all that. I can't help thinking about this, that, you know, yesterday I happened to go see Avatar 2. That's what the movie's all about. It's all about that connection and that union. It's the spirit union. And obviously, Mr. Cameron is extremely tuned in. He has to be tuned in to do this movie from the follow-up from the first one. When I was watching it, because it was first right up my line, I kept thinking, like, how beautiful this is that somebody's showing this to the world, you know, because they can call it fantasy, they can call it whatever it is. But if you're at all connected, you're going to see how the interspecies and how the unions and how the animals saved them. And I don't know if you've seen it, but it's quite incredible. I couldn't wait to see it. And I knew this was the good week to do it, but it stays with you. And it really has all those elements of interconnection between children and adults, animals, and our animals with animals, and being part of that and learning to listen. Like, that's what I See You is about. That's really what that open heart is all about.
It's so interesting that you bring that up every, maybe not every night, almost every night when my husband and I lie down to go to sleep. We always intend to clear our energy. He's been quite influenced by me, of course.
He's a good guy, then. He goes along with it.
Oh, he doesn't just go along with it. He's an amazing human being.
That's great. That's great.
Wait till you hear the story. I'll get a hit. Look at his energy, or ask him to look at your energy, or we need to talk to one of our animals. We have 11 animals on the ranch.
Oh, God.
Last night, I said, I think I'm supposed to ask you to look at my energy. And so he was quiet for a while. And he said, I don't think I can today. All I'm seeing is the earth underwater. And I said, I think we're supposed to go see the Avatar movie.
Wow. Oh, that's amazing. That's really amazing. Oh, that's pretty cool. For me, the last one was 2009. That's how long it took for this to come out again. People forget how long it was, but that's like almost 15 years or 14 years or something. So, you know, clearly as a master at it. It's so wonderful, especially in the world, the way the world is. So, you know, chaotic and split and, you know, whatever, that somebody can really, I mean, clearly he's not only tuned in, he's had to talk to a few folks like me for sure, because you don't know that language unless you've actually spoke with somebody who speaks that language. So people think when you say that you see spirit, you're seeing spirit, but actually it's not physically or visually seeing the spirit. It means the seeing connection. A lot of people miss that because they think that if you haven't seen, you know, your dead relatives or you haven't seen spirit, you're not seeing it. But it's actually the traditional term. If you've gone back from originally when it used to be from the French of seeing, like the French would talk about sessions as a sitting, and sitting actually means seance. but Sans had such a bad connotation, because I know my first book I came out was called The Seance, A Guide for the Living. And, you know, they always felt like that was not, would spook people up, because people have this bad connotation of seance because of Hollywood. If they really knew that seance was taken from the French and it means a sitting, it means a sitting with a group of people. So when you talk about a scene, that's what the scene means. It means that sort of that same sort of a connection type of thing. So the fact that he used that, not even analogy, but if he used those words, obviously from the first one, and you see it, and the second one, how he uses it, you know, when I see you, it means heart to heart, spirit to spirit communication.
Yeah, there are definitely so many refined layers or nuances of the abilities. And certainly there's clairaudience and there's clairvoyance. But
clairsentient,
which is knowing. Yes. And the knowing is where you can say there's a pink elephant in the room. It's 7 feet tall and you don't see it because you're using your claircognizance. But I can remember so many times where I've said to someone, well, I think your dead aunt is here and she's wearing a cute little poodle skirt and she's dressed to the nines and she has her gloves and her purse or what have you. Oh my gosh, you'll appreciate this one. I was at a church because they were having near-death experiencer talks there. And I went to go see the person talking. I guess the priest of the church, it was an Episcopal church. So priest came up to me and he knew who I was. And he said, oh, I'd love to have you come and speak here and let me give you a tour of the church. And so we went into the sanctuary and I just turned to him and I said, I know you might not believe this, but one of your parishioners is here and they're very upset at you. He said, what? And I said, she's really upset. You're not doing the service. You're not having a service for her. And he said, no, actually, the family hasn't asked me to do that. And she said, well, this is her church and she wants it to be in this church. And I said, by the way, she's wearing the most beautiful blue dress and she's dancing. And he said, oh, yeah, you're definitely talking to her.
So all it is the validations. Yes. And that's why you understand the validation is so important, because I was on book tour twice for 4 months. When I went to Mexico, I never stopped. They had me working from morning through noon through night, because in that culture, you know, Dia de Muertos, Day of the Dead, is that is the holy day of their culture. So I was like the queen to them. I was just like, you know, friction and radio stoves, you know, prove me, you know, and stuff like that. Because you can't say you're going to talk to the dead and not deal with it. But I encountered that obviously a lot through this country. Never encountered it, only with one person the whole time I was in Mexico. It's not something that has to be proven. It's something that they're raised with that as part of what you do. You do that celebration. You go to the cemetery. You don't cry. You bring food. You bring music. You dance. You know, they're part of your family that's sort of still. You don't think twice about it. But our culture is very much left brain on a lot of levels. So everything is about proving. It's like proving that this dead person exists. And so the only way you can do that is exactly what you did through validation. Couldn't even question it, because he knew whatever you said to her was exactly, oh, wow, that's her in a nutshell. Even being a pastor, you know? So, and some pastors are in, some pastors are not. But when you can somehow suspend the fact of disbelief and that all things are possible on some level of awareness or consciousness or whatever you want to call it, then you can be open to the experience. Otherwise, you're closed down. And unfortunately, you add that with the fear of a loss or the grief of the loss. You know, I always say that sometimes grief is the size of New York City, which is true when people have these grand losses. Even if their loved ones are trying to connect to them or come to them, they can't bring them in because the grief is just too overwhelming.
I've definitely refunded somebody's money one time. Just the woman was so hysterical and I knew it. And I said, can you wait a few weeks and then book a session with me? And she did. But still, she was so hysterical. Yeah. I just said, I'm really sorry. If this doesn't feel like an appropriate time, I might not be the animal communicator for you, you know?
Right.
And then
right.
From that moment on, I actually dissuade people on my website from booking sessions for me purely for mediumship, because that is very tough, the grief.
But, yes.
You know, Suzanne, and please feel free to continue with this.
No, yeah, this is good.
When you were talking about the validation, that led me to thinking about a question that I wanted to ask you. If you're open to just share, how has this work changed your life? How does it change your clients' life, the people that you interact with? Because I see for myself, I don't need convincing. I see for myself every day the changes in the animals, the changes in the people, just through that simple interspecies communication. Right. But what you really specialize is that multidimensional spirit communication. And that is just so life-changing. So please feel free to share any stories that you want.
I live in the Northeast and I live in New York. And obviously there's a lot of history in New York. I don't have to tell you that. I've met with a lot of families that have lost families in the Holocaust. I mean, I had a student of mine, this is maybe 20 years ago. She would come to my classes. She was Jewish. And we sort of stayed friendly, even though she sort of stopped studying with me. And she ended up marrying a rabbi. She was so thrilled because, you know, that was the whole thing. Her mother couldn't wait for her to get married. And then she ends up marrying a rabbi. She contacted me when she got pregnant. She goes, I'd love to have lunch with you. And caught up on what's going on. But they had lunch together. Immediately, I said, you know, you're going to have twins. She goes, you know, how do you know? And I just know. Cheryl, I said, this is crazy, but there's twins here. But there was twins that were lost in your family. I mean, there were twins that died. She goes, oh, that's like, that's no way. I'm an only child. And I said, I don't have to tell you. So we kind of like let it go. And maybe it was like a year or two later, you know, she had twins. She had twin daughters. We went and had lunch together. And I just said to her, I said, I know that you could think I'm really crazy here. I said, but I'm telling you, these daughters were born in your family before. And she said, you know, I've known you for like a long time. She said, I've asked my mother. And my mother says, no, you're the only child. You know, there was no other twins in the family, yada, yada, yada. So she says, okay, I've had it. You know, I'm going to go home. I'm going to call my mother. I'm going to take her out to dinner. I'm going to give her a drink and make her listen to me. So she did. And in the middle of the dinner, her mother broke down. And she said, well, you know, I lost most of my family in the Holocaust. She said, before you're born, I had twin girls. And she said, I was so distraught of their loss that I couldn't handle the thought of ever having another loss in my life. Because she apparently had lost her whole family to the Holocaust. She loses her first two born. You know, Cheryl said to her mother, because don't worry, because I have your babies. So she was totally convinced that these little girls that died were those girls. And she said that all those years of denial and all those years of not being able to go down that road because the grief was so enormous of her losing her whole family. And in the thought that she would lose her daughter after losing the other daughters. Or that true story always sticks in my head. Because it was like she had carried the loss of her whole family. And then she has babies and those babies are, you know, they die. That's a lot to carry. That was a lot to carry. So, you know, she was obviously very protective of Cheryl. She would always like make sure when you go out, you don't do this, you don't go that. Yeah, she said it was like she smothered me to death because she lived in this fear of another loss. There's always thousands of stories in the Naked City, but that's one that I always kind of remember really strong. And then I had another client of mine that I had seen also for many, many years who, interesting enough, had three children, two daughters and a son, and both her daughters were killed in a car accident together. She came and saw me during that time. They showed up right away. It wasn't their fault. It was a drunk driver. They came through right away and immediately we stayed in contact. And then I think it was maybe 4 or 5 years later, her husband died. So there was just really just her and her son left. And she came to see me again. And I just remember when she came into the room, she was like, because, you know, we know each other for a long time and, you know, we've lost our daughters and, you know, my husband just went over. And I remember looking at her and I said, you're really like an amazing woman because I never feel, and I know, God, you had to have a tremendous grief in your life, but I always feel like when you come in, you're so positive. It's like you come in and it's just sort of like you know that they're going to be fine, but you just kind of want to touch base. And I'm the in-between for you to touch base and just losing your husband and only having your son left. And I looked at her and I said, tell me your secret. And she said, if you don't have love in your heart, you're not going to bring any more love into your life. And it's really true because what happens is that, you know, when your heart is broken, your natural instinct is to shut down. And so it's hard, you know, people always want to say, like, I want to meet somebody, I want to bring somebody in my life. And I'm saying, because when we lose people, you have to really do a very big step to be able to open up your heart again so that you can bring love into your life again. Because who wants to be with somebody who's a downer or can't move on to their life and can't give the opportunity of the second chance? That's why my book was called Second Chance of Love. I never forgot that story. And it was a grand reminder to me, which I sometimes share with people that have gone through those losses, and particularly like young women that have lost their spouses or have lost children or both or whatever, that your life is still young. To be in your 40s and lose people is young. You get like a full life in front of you. Why should you not only deprive yourself, but deprive somebody else of your love of giving them? Because that's one of the things we have, one of the things that we have, hopefully, as human beings, to share that connection. John Edward, I've known for a long time. He did this big retreat in Barbados. It was a long time ago, like 20, 25 years ago. And there was the whole retreat, there was like four mediums. Each one would have a session with all the group, and the group kind of would go around to each sort of medium. So this woman had gone to like three of the other meetings, and she walked up to John and she said, I'm really like bummed out because, you know, I came to talk to my dog, and my dog hasn't showed up with all the mediums. And John says to her, well, have you seen Suzanne yet? And she goes, no, I'm seeing her next. Your dog will show up. The dog was the first one that showed up on the group. So
I was going to ask if any other types of spirit experiences show up. For example, if I know someone that's pregnant, every single time, whether they're a friend or a colleague or a family member, I will have a vision of being in the maternity waiting ward,
right?
Knowing that they're in the room giving birth and I'm sitting in the rocking chair holding the soul in a blue or a pink blanket. And sometimes with the mother of the person, so the grandmother's there, and these are the visions. And then I'll say, oh, you're having a boy, or oh, you're having a girl, or, and I can see their parents, and I might have never met their parents before, but I can perfectly describe their mother or whomever showed up in the waiting room with me.
And because they're there to help bring the child in, because we are the canals, we are the vehicles. That's really all we're only there to bring that child from spirit into physical life. That's it. That's, you know, and I'm sure you've seen plenty of animals being born and whatever it is. And once you see that, how anybody could think that it's just a vehicle? I mean, I hate to say it, but that's really all we are, is vehicles to get from one non-physical foundation. And to, you know, I mean, I just remember that was the most visible thing that I saw when my nephew was born. It was almost like my sister was just a canal. That was the only purpose she was, is to bring him from the non-physical realm into the physical realm. And it's really true, because that's what we are. We are all vehicles on all different kinds of like levels. But, you know, I've always had obviously a thing strong with animals. So you're going to appreciate this story. This is one of my very, very different animal stories. I've talked to the mules that have gone down to the Grand Canyon. I've talked to people that have had pigs. I just had a woman the other day that, you know, her husband came through and I said, who had all the rabbits? Well, that was my second husband. He had all the rabbits. I says, he collected rabbits. She goes, yeah, he collected rabbits. And she goes, don't other people collect rabbits? I go, no, other people don't collect rabbits. She was in a group. It was another one of those that different people were waiting for different people to sort of show up. And I look at her and I see this and I said, okay. And I said, Suzanne, you've totally lost your mind, because I saw this thing and I said, this looks like an anguilla or something like that. It's like reptile. I can't explain it. The skin. And I said, but the strangest thing is it looks to me like it's on a bed with wheels. Now, I thought if I didn't give the information the way that I got it, this person would have been thinking I was going to lose my mind. But that was, weirdly enough, is before the anguilla showed up, her dead husband showed up. But it was like she didn't want to talk to her dead husband. It was the craziest part. She had no interest in talking to her dead husband. But meanwhile, when this thing that looked to me like some kind of a anguilla, alligator, I couldn't help it. But I saw it on this thing that had wheels. So she breaks down in the middle of the room. I mean, literally breaks down in the middle of the room, Jenny, and she's hysterical. I mean, and everybody in the room was like looking at this woman who was hysterical. And of course, nobody knows what I'm talking about. I don't know what I'm talking about. This is just what I see. Well, this woman did lose her Gila monster, her anguilla. That was her pet. And he was so big that when he was dying, they had to put him on a thing to wheel him into the room or wheel him out of the room. And that was her last mission attempt. So if I would have not said it how I said it, and not trusted it, she would have never thought it was coming through. So sometimes it's the things that you think are the wayest out that you say it, because you know what? They're going to validate it or invalidate it and just say, like, you know, there's a reason I'm getting this. I can't tell you why I'm getting this, but this is what I see. Take it for what it is. And sometimes people will take certain things. It's like the things that sometimes you think are the wayest out are the things they may not listen to. And they listen to the other stuff that's like, you know, like flowery and whatever. But that's not always a validation. You want a validation that you're going to know without a question that it's the person that they want to connect to. You have to just sometimes take those big leaps. That was a big leap, even for me. Because I couldn't quite tell what it was, except for I knew it had leathery skin and it kind of looked to me like those kind of animals. Sure enough, that's what it was.
You know what's really fascinating? Please share if you've had experiences like this. Animals can see spirits too.
Animals they see them easily. They see them easier than humans.
It's so hard sometimes for people to believe that animals can, you know, some of their behavior problem, if they're peeing on the bed or they're acting funny or what have you, or they bark in the car when they go through a certain intersection. I've had all of that. I had a client with one dog that would go crazy going through an intersection. And there were so many accidents there that there were so many souls that were just shocked and lost.
Right. Because the dog was picking them up.
Yeah.
Right.
So I called their guides forward and I asked them to come and, you know, handle that situation. It was, of course, very beautiful. Next time she drove through the intersection, the dog didn't bark.
Right.
And I had a
Because she validated it for the dog. It's the same thing. I always say, when you see your dog look at something, you don't see anything there. And they're wagging their tails. It's because there's somebody or a person or an animal in the room with them. And once you make that acknowledgement, you know, you're letting them know that you know too. Whether you don't see them or not, it's irrelevant.
Yeah. I had a client in Hawaii once and I said, well, your dog is telling me that he's very psychic and he can see everything that goes on in your house. And when he's showing me your house and it just looks like the most beautiful artist palette and there's color everywhere. Do you have any sense of what that might mean? And she said, well, I'm an artist and I work with color therapy.
Right.
But it was non-physical, though. The energy, she was an artist, but she was an intuitive. And she,
right. But the energy was manifest. Energy was manifesting itself.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, I could tell stories like that until the cows come home.
But that's how I feel. Yes. That's the whole beauty when you are able to tell others, this is what we do. This was our program. But it doesn't mean that what you have happened to you is any less important. Because if you think of it in the way of, I always think of it as in the way in communication, it's like they want to communicate with you because they want you, one, they know that you're still in whatever that state of grief or loss, whatever. They want you to know they're okay so that you can be okay. That becomes their job once they make their transition. Their job is to connect with you any way they can. Your job, be the harder one, honestly, is to be able to somehow, you know, like I said, grief doesn't happen in a day or a week or whatever it is, but you have to let them know that you're ready. And when you're ready, maybe they'll come to a way that won't be freaked out. Like that's why they come in dreams, because dreams, we're in a state of mind, we can handle it a lot more easier than walking into the room or whatever it is. And they'll take their cues from you. And if you've got pushy people in your family, you got to let them know that also, you know, that what they can handle. It's all about how it works or how it works for us or how it works in terms of that sort of that connection. That was actually why I wrote the cookbook, because I really wanted to put together like a step-by-step way of connection. And I use the cook, and I don't cook. I use the cookbook analogy because even if you don't cook, you know that, you know, things come out of the pantry or this may mix with that or that may not mix with that. And that became sort of my structure, an idea of how you can make the connections. That was really, really an important book for me to write for that, because I didn't think there had been anything was like a really detailed step-by-step book that had been written in that kind of arena. But that was really my purpose for writing that book. It's a quite wonderful journey. I know you feel quite honored to do it in your perspective. That's how I've always felt within my perspective. I'm still doing this. I'm still standing doing this.
Well, I've had the urge to ask you a few random questions. One of them, and this goes way back to the beginning of the conversation, but when you moved back east, you moved to New York because you had said you did $2 readings on the street in New York. So did you move first?
$3. Yes.
Oh, $3, pardon me.
Yes, yes. Yes, I moved to New York City. Once I got the message to move back, the person lived in New York City. So when I went back there, I didn't have a lot of options to make a living. I had gotten my degree in music, but I was very clear I never really wanted to teach music. I wanted to write. That's what I really wanted to do. You just can't like arrive at a place and sort of do that. But this is what I could do because I had already been doing it in LA for, you know, for several years. I'd been involved with this from the minute I moved to LA after living up in Northern California. So I had been there for, you know, at least 4 or 5 years. And the minute I got there is when I got connected to the Masonic Temple in the church with this woman, Trudy Jarnell, which, by the way, was pretty well known for her life. And interesting enough, she moved from Eastern Europe where her family had been in the Holocaust. Yes, so she had moved to LA and she started this spiritual church. She didn't do medium stuff. She did a lot of psychic sort of stuff. She really wanted to ordain me, but I was not interested. As much as I liked her, it wasn't a path I wanted to go down. But then she had this woman come and lecture, the one I was telling you about, to work with the police department. And I saw her and I said, if I'm going to study, that's who I want to study with. And that's what happened. So I ended up studying with her. We worked in different arenas, but she was a task maker. I mean, she was a real task maker. She would make me stand up and hit my source and give messages. And if I didn't hit them 100%, slap on the hand. I mean, she was tough. There is an ethic thing. I had that drilled in me, really drilled into me. You have a tremendous responsibility. You have to take that and heed that with every session or every message that you give, because you got people's hands and, you know, hearts in your hands. So she was a real task maker. So I really had a great teacher. And when I talk about this, unless you go maybe to England and study, you know, I mean, I don't know what's going on in the teaching world anymore, but I know that there are people that aren't teaching that part. And that is as much important as the messages you give. It's probably somewhat more because it's an ethics thing. And if you don't have that, I don't care what field you're in. That's got to be the core. If you're a teacher, anybody, because you're dealing with hearts and you're dealing with children. And this one is a real important one. And it's like, this is not just so you get known, but it's like, I remember in at the beginning when I would be doing these big events in Boston and they would go up to the guys and they'd say, did Suzanne come in the limo? And they go, no, she drove her Jeep. Because it's, you can be known in your field, but that doesn't mean you leave that other part behind. Because being known, it's like, I remembered the basketball player who actually just died this year. I think his last name is Russell. He says, I'm not a basketball player. He said, I'm just a man who plays basketball. So it was like he had his, because he was more than basketball. He was a father. He was a teacher. He was a son. He was a brother, you know. And we are all those things, not just what we do. But when you do something that is so, has, you can't put a price on it. You can't, it's something that goes to kind of a whole other level. Because what's always amazing to me is that the number one fear is still death. And that just blows me out of the water. I mean, I would think it'd be snakes or something like that. But it's like, it's always such an amazement to me that is really, and even people that I know, they still grapple with that. And that to me is kind of like a mind boggle. I mean, not that I'm, you know, rushing to go anywhere, but it's just sort of like, I personally can't wrap my head around, like, you know, when it's the program, it's the program. When you see people that you know who clearly are suffering, either physically or mentally, whatever, it's just like, to me, it's like, it's time to leave. It's like, it's time to take the aim, but that's me. I'm, you know, other people, that's not so okay. Some people just hang on and hang on and hang on. And why they'd want to stay in that body that way, I don't know, but that's their journeys. Hopefully not going to be mine.
I'll share with you that it is one of the more advanced fears. From my perspective, it's not a fear you address early on in your journey, you know, mm-hmm. working intuitively with people. It's a very touchy subject and can trigger people, even people you would have never
guessed, thought. Yes.
Never thought. I was asked to do a workshop with someone because of my ability, and I did that. And it was on fear of riding horses, right? Mm-hmm. And we did the workshop, and the woman that had asked me to do the workshop was sort of half in, half out. I wasn't really sure, was she not happy with me when I showed up or what was going on? And she said, well, you know, to be honest, as we were sort of driving back to the hotel, my issue is a fear of death. I just have a fear of death. Well, then we had some other work we were doing together, another workshop the next day and on a different topic. And we were driving home and she was going rather fast down a country lane and she ran over a cat and the cat died. And she was hysterical. She was hysterical. And I said, just stay here. I'll handle everything. I got out. I walked a quarter mile down the road and knocked on doors and found who owned the cat, expressed my sincerest concern and condolences. Sure. And what can we do? And and by that time she had made herself up to that. She was still bawling and just hysterical. And we stood there and we waited for someone to get a little box and a blanket. And we were just this protracted experience. And we walked back to the car and she's still crying. And why did this happen? Why would this happen? And I said, do you really want to know? Because if you are you really asking me why, or are you just lamenting why? And she said, no, I really want to know. And I said, to prepare you for death, that death is a part of life.
Absolutely.
Well, a month later, one of her beloved animals passed away. And she texted me the most vile, horrific, how dare you? Who would talk to somebody like that? What is wrong with you? And I said, anybody that is in the industry that you are in, which is what you teach, and it's kind of adjunct to what we do, should know the answer to that question. Yes. So I will honor your grief, and I will let you be in peace.
Right.
And, like they say. But she was hysterical. So even people that you think are really dialed in or together, you know, a lot of people, it seems like they have a together life, but it's not actually that together.
Right. Well, you know, it means is that you don't believe in accidents even when they're accidents.
It wasn't an accident.
That's what I'm saying. That's my point. That's right. That's right. Yes.
There are no accidents. And I was there with her to support her through that. But the point is she couldn't receive that. She wasn't ready to receive, right? There was so much fear and resistance that even in the understanding, even in the eventual, you know, there was no ability to receive because the fear was greater than the faith.
Correct. And I'm sure you know, as I know, that it's very more common than not common for that to happen right before it's going to happen to you personally. It's like, this is a message. Heed this because this means something, whether you want to see it or not. Sure enough.
I love how much emphasis you put on what an honor it is to do the work, on what profound tenderness it evokes in people, in yourself, in those who receive the messages, in those who have the experiences. And I have to be honest, I talk to a lot of people all day long. I mean, I easily talk to, not professionally, but six or eight people I will talk to or touch base with or have children. I have friends, you know, and I've interviewed a lot of people and I've traveled all around. I rarely meet someone that when I greet them as a soul, the greeting is returned in a similar level of, let's say, reverence, honoring, light, love, compassion. Mm-hmm. And from the moment you started talking, your soul was greeting me with that light. And I'm so grateful to know people who cultivate their heart to that degree that the gratitude flows. You can feel it. I can feel it. And I appreciate you so much.
That's great. Thank you. I think, obviously, it's who I am, but I think that because I've done this work for so long, and I remember when I started this work out, I told you, you know, I mean, the only way you could do this was churches or psychic fairs. That's all there was. It's all that was available. And I remember when I would do the psychic fairs and I'd arrive in the morning and I'd always have a line of people waiting for me. And I just remember like the other practitioners were like insanely jealous of me. Got to watch your back because you never know when there's going to be, you know, an arrow thrown at it. And it was just like, I kept thinking, that's why I've never liked to use the love and life expression, because it's love and light until you turn your back. And so it's just a word. It doesn't mean anything. And it's all in with what your actions were. But I remember that because I got that learned really right from the beginning of my profession. And then on top of it, like I said, you know, I had a tyrant for a teacher. she drilled into me, you know, the whole things of ethics. The one moment that I gave a message out, she goes, you better re-hit your source because you don't know what the hell you're talking about. I felt like about this high. That was a teacher for that, was a great teaching for me. Is that, you know, the minute you put your ego in the middle of it, then you not only don't work the way you should be working, you know, receiving the messages the way you should be receiving the messages, you feel like you're above, and no one is above. No one is. I'm sure like you, you know, I've spoken to people that are very rich and people that are very poor, and their goods and bads and whatever. It's the person and what you want to have come across. And that's, if you're going to, you personally, again, if you're going to be in this field, then if you're not doing that, then that's just my, you know, not a judgment. It's an adjustment, because the world needs his love. That's true. You know, many mountains, but this work really is basically people. When I do any kind of show, it's about love. It's not complicated. Yeah, it's about death, but it's about love. And it's about, you know, my work's about the living people, not the dead people, because the dead people are on the next journey. It's the living people that are here left with the figuring out, the wise. And it's like, I know you know this true, is that the truth is, you're never going to know what the wise are, because you're never going to know their true journey, because they're the only one who really knows their true journey or their souls. You know, I was just talking to my partner the other day about the guy Trix that, you know, that killed himself on Ellen's show. And it's just sort of like everybody, they don't understand why, but they're never going to understand why, because they don't know what his demons were. They don't know, you know, he on the outer, he had this incredible world, but we don't work on the outer. We don't work on the outer. We work on the inner. Your inner is you can't get out of a hole. You don't know how to get out of a hole. You know, can I say? So no one really knows anybody's real personal journey to that. Would have, could have, should have, why didn't I see that? Because for some reason you really weren't supposed to see that, or he chose not to share it, or whatever. You can't, the $1 million question. It's in the journey, and I have no doubt that whatever space he's in, he's receiving all the love that he needs at this time. Unfortunately, his family, they need unbelievable love, because I talk about this, that when I would do my events, I would say, you know, the first year of death is really, really, really hard. But the second year is even harder, because the first year, generally, you have people around you or people that come to see you or, you know, whatever. But the second year, they're on their own lives, or even 6 months later, they're onto their own lives. And it doesn't mean they don't love you, and it doesn't mean that they don't care, and it doesn't mean they don't want to be there. But most people at that point, they've gone on with their own lives. You're still in that place. You're still in that loss. First year, you're numb. You're in shock. Like, I can't believe this is real. But the second year, you realize it is real. That phone isn't going to ring, or they're not going to walk through that door. You're going to never physically see them again. But you got to try to, if they want to make some kind of a connection, that's up to you. That is up to you. And that's why I think that when you have a session, like you have a session or I have a session, that not always, if people can take it in and really truly believe that they have some kind of, you know, asset to that also, and it opens up the door for them, then you've done your job. And then later on, when if they see you, they'll say, like, you know, you gave me that, Jenny. You gave me that trust that I have that connection with my dog. I have that connection with my horse. I have that connection with that woman or that man or that whomever came to me. You gave them that, you know, you opened up, they had to open up the door, but you gave them the opportunity to do that. And that's a gift. It doesn't get better than that.
I'll share one of my favorite sayings, which can easily be misunderstood by, I think, one of the most remarkable clairvoyant teachers in the world, who you may know, Michael Tamora. Mm-hmm. In his very first level clairvoyant classes, but it's the second class, I think, he says, whole purpose of living is learning how to die. And what he means by that is being self-aware, so that when we die, we don't carry our fears with us.
Right.
So that when we die, we don't die with regret.
Yes.
So that we understand what death truly represents. And when I heard him say that years ago, I first took his first series of classes, I just thought, what a genius. I've never heard anybody say that before.
Well, because the truth is that if you don't do it now, life changes on a dime. So if you have that awareness that life can change like that, which we know that's what happens with death. So if you're living your life like that, then you're fully aware of that aspect.
Right.
So this has been, I think a good note to go to the next level. I think this has been really, really nice.
Thank you, Suzanne. It has been quite a joy. And I love being in your energy. So please come back anytime. If you write a new book or have a new project, I want to hear about it first.
Okay. You got it. You got it.
I will have all of your information in the podcast notes below for people to contact you, and we will share your books as well.
Perfect.
Please go ahead and offer any final thoughts.
My final thoughts are that I think if you can know, there is a continuum, and that continuum is all of this based in love. It is totally based in love. You may not see them the way you want to see them here, but you will see everybody that you love again. And you got to know that they want that connection to happen like you want that connection to happen. And it doesn't matter what that species is. Doesn't matter what that species is.
Absolutely. And my podcast continues. I invite the listeners to return again next week for another conversation with me. Because now is the time for interspecies evolution. The information provided in this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional, medical, psychiatric, or veterinary advice. Our conversations are based on our life's experiences. We intend this podcast to be complementary and supportive. It is not intended to be a substitute for traditional medical, psychiatric, or veterinary care. If you need a doctor, a psychiatrist, or a veterinarian, please contact one immediately.